reaches a crisis point, it seems to me, in high school. Many refugees from high school have ended up in my office because they are dealing with tremendous pressure to decide on their vocational identities. They have to decide who they want to be for the rest of their lives, because that will determine their major, that will determine what college to which they apply, that will then determine whether they have a chance of getting in and whether they have a chance of abject failure. So there's a lot of pressure. And I'm not. Okay. So this is my high school, Salinas High School, where I lived through some of these crises myself. And I can remember feeling a lot of pressure to decide the rest of my life. Maybe not as much as the people who are going through this now. I applied to one college. I got into one college. I was kind of casual about it. I could be back then. Now, I know what you're thinking. I've shown a picture of my high school. You probably think I'm going to show you a picture of me in high school. Let me confess, I am not as courageous as Lee Cook. But so as not to disappoint you altogether, this is a picture of me. Somehow this works. This is a picture of me if I were George Clooney in high school. I think I would have felt a lot better about myself if I looked like that in high school. Trust me, that's an upgrade from when I was in high school. At least I think people would have thought better of me. And this, too, is a hallmark of adolescence, to be preoccupied with what other people are thinking of me. And that preoccupation should end when adolescents realize that everybody else is thinking the same thing. They're too busy thinking about what you're thinking of them to really think about you. But nevertheless, that paradox is sort of lost on them. But this, nevertheless, makes adolescents very vulnerable to the evaluations of their peers. And many get quite damaged by the criticisms, real or imagined, that they get from their cohorts. But we don't have to leave our insecurities about high school in our teen years. We can bring them forward into the present by attending one of the staples of American culture, the high school reunion. And back again. There we go. This is counter. Oh, okay. That's how it works. It's this way. Okay. So, I have to admit, I have some mixed feelings about high school reunions. I've attended all of mine. I even dug my wife's invitation to her high school reunion out of the trash and insisted that we go. And we went, and I actually had a better time than she did, I think. I'm more of the extrovert in the family. But my own reunion is a little bit different matter. I do feel some ambivalence because it's good to reconnect with people. But on the other hand, I feel like I'm going through a kind of a judgment day, where not only will people evaluate how much I increasingly look like George Clooney, but they will evaluate me for how well I've done with my life vocationally. And of course, I would like to be able to report that I won the Nobel Peace Prize or the National League batting title. I'd be okay with either one. But of course, I have to report more modest accomplishments. It's okay, I'm dealing with it. But I do enjoy one aspect of high school reunions, and that is witnessing a reversal of the social order. Because the most accomplished in my class were not necessarily those who enjoyed the highest status in high school. Out of the brainy outcasts, a 10 years. It's quite a turnaround from the culture of my high school. And really, pretty much any American high school. Philip Yancey years ago said that if you want evidence for the theory of evolution, you need go no further than the typical American high school where the survival of the fittest still holds sway. And beauty and strength are the criteria for survival. Because let's face it, if you're in high school and you're male, and you're big, strong, and fast, especially if you're all three, or if you're female and you're pretty, you've got at least a head start to the upper echelons of high school status. But the aforementioned revenge of the nerds is, of course, inevitable. Because, for example, unless you are in the 1% of the 1%, those who make a living as a professional athlete, the fact that you can play linebacker is not especially relevant to the adult world. And I remember getting a foreshadowing of this on graduation day when the smartest kids in the class were seated in the front row and the valedictorian gave the address and the most accomplished were asked to stand. And I remember sitting there that day, not in the front row, regretting that I had not invested more time and energy in what was proven to be most important on that day. I could have been in that front row, I think. But the message of graduation day was clear. Beginning today, being smart counts. And so it has worked out for those who have accomplished a great deal within the adult world. So that judgment day of graduation was one milestone, but there is great wisdom, really, in looking at that as an indication of how we evaluate our present from the vantage point of the future. Even the Lexus car company knows this. There was an ad that came out several years ago in which there were quick cuts of this young, very attractive couple enjoying all manner of luxuries. They were engaging in fine dining, going to exotic destinations, having private concerts, swimming in their own private swimming pool. And the voiceover said, "Someday your life will flash before you. Make it worth watching." And then the end of it, the ad was Lexus, the pursuit of perfection. Now I added a little hand thing, but the advertisement is basically that when you come to the end of your life, you want to make your life worth watching. A couple of observations I want to make about this ad. This couple engaging in all these luxurious activities are alone. They're alone together. But that signifies one aspect of the American notion of success, that you get to be away from the people that you don't like. We have a word for talking about certain opportunities not available to other people. We call them exclusive opportunities, exclusive clubs. And the other observation, of course, is that their lives are worth watching. It looks good. And now, in this era of social media, we can create our own advertisements to make ourselves look good. So every day could be judgment day. We can provoke envy, and we can feel envy. So we don't have to go to high school reunions. As a matter of fact, a New York Times article assessing how social media has undermined the institution of the high school reunion, because people keep up with each other on social media. They don't need to come together because they already know what's going on. So I don't need to see you face to face to know that you took a vacation to the Swiss Alps. Show off. But the judgment day of being in the midst of social media or whatever the venue is ends up hurting a lot of people because the judgments are based on distorted standards. The ultimate judgment day This is somebody going on social media as a retreat from the high school reunion. The ultimate judgment day to which this passage refers in Philippians chapter 2 is a judgment day in which we see that what ultimately matters is not how well you've done with your brawn, beauty, or even your brains, or even how well you've done for yourself, and how well you've done for others. That's what is proven as ultimately worthy, how we've done for others. And instead of trying to position ourselves so we can consider ourselves better than others, we value others above ourselves. Instead of just pursuing our own interests, we look to other people's interests. And this is an attitude that we should have, a mindset that we take on as exemplified by Jesus Christ. We didn't hold on to his status as the Son of God. That's a pretty good status. But instead, emptied himself of that status and took the form of a slave. This translation says servant. Most of the translations say servant. It makes it a little bit more palatable, but it's slave. The Greek word is slave. This would not have gone over very well for the original readers. The original readers who were very much influenced by Greek culture would have been offended by this notion, because the Greek ideal of a free person, a free man, to be honest, was someone who had no evidence of any subjugation. There was absolute contempt for the idea of submission. And here we have the challenge become slaves, to put others first, to value them ahead of you. This not only doesn't fly very well with ancient Greek culture, it doesn't fly very well in contemporary Western civilization. We have a great emphasis on the individual. We think of ourselves first and foremost as individuals, not as members of a community, certainly not members of a human community, a global community, but we think of ourselves as individuals. And so our sensibilities against any kind of communitarian values are really heightened by the influences of the thought leaders who have preceded us. This being one of them, Martin Luther. Martin Luther brought a needed corrective to theology by emphasizing salvation by faith through grace. And in so doing, he took on the tyranny of the Catholic Church that made impossible rigid requirements for getting into a right relationship with God. asserted a monopoly on mediating the relationship between God and people. Luther made it possible for us to think differently, that we could stand in direct relationship to God, that we could stand in a gracious, loving relationship to God, and be priests in our own right. Luther's thought paved the way for the Reformation principle of the priesthood of all believers. And so this was a necessary change in the course of human history. But if we take Lutheranism to a distorted extreme, then we can end up with a preoccupation with our own individual salvation, with our own individual internal experience, to the point where sometimes the Christian faith can resemble New Age religions more than it really resembles a biblical faith. And so, against that is this passage, which talks about the crucifixion not just as a means of understanding the atonement for us. The crucifixion here is given as an example that we should follow, that we should love to the death. That is our call. And so we are not just preoccupied with ourselves, but we are to be preoccupied with the greater good. But there's also the influence of this guy, Adam Smith, who is regarded as the father of laissez-faire economics, who talked about how pursuing our self-interest would, like an invisible hand, also promote the public interest. And Adam Smith came along at a time where a needed corrective was provided by taking on the tyranny of government and preventing the flourishing that can happen when people take initiative, when they can enjoy the fruits of their labors. This is a good thing that has come from Adam Smith's philosophy of laissez-faire economics, that people work hard and they achieve and they dream big. But it doesn't always work out that pursuing our own self-interest leads to the greater common interest. Otherwise, why this command to look to others' interests? We have an epistemological problem, a problem of knowing what is truth if we are just to pursue whatever it is that would satisfy us, and it all just works out, when, in contradiction to that, we are challenged to think about the interests of others. And even Adam Smith wasn't as Adam Smithian as many of his ardent devotees. He too talked about thinking about the good of the whole and thinking about the results that could happen when we just pursue our own self-interest, as this quote indicates. And then we have Francis Bacon, who was a scientist but also a philosopher, and he advocated that countries embrace science as a way of subduing the tyranny of nature. And certainly, when he was alive, nature was a tyranny. People were subjected to exposure, to disease, to early death, to hunger. And so Bacon said that we must harness nature, subdue it, and defeat it. And he further talked about how the power of nations derives from the ability to overcome the vagaries of nature. But here, too, Bacon leads to the conclusion that we are at the top of the food chain. And that all sounds very superior. But actually, being at the top of the food chain means we are dependent on all the species below us. And so when we read about the UN report that just came out indicating that up to a million species are at risk of extinction because of human activity, we are not entirely free of nature. Extinction is coming for us. We need the other species. The other species can do just fine without us. And so we are constrained by the limits of nature, but we're also constrained by the moral mandate to think about the good of the whole, to think about others. And the more we apply the law of love universally, the more we distinguish ourselves as Christians. Check this out. Every major religion has some version of the golden rule. They all do. And so the Christian faith is unique, not in its ethic so much as in its universality. Christ died for all. That is the basis of our ethical stance. And this has tremendous implications for our macroeconomics, for our macro political policy, but it also has implications for even the small things, the things that we do. I know that many of you have thought about people and cared for them in a way that has not advanced your interests whatsoever. We have people who are going to Mexico, going to the Dominican Republic, who are working with Kids Hope. We have deacons. We have breast cancer support groups, diabetes support groups. You are doing these things. You're just maintaining the building. And you're doing so in a way that doesn't enhance your status. You're giving it away without any recompense, without any quid pro quo. We do this, and we thereby prove ourselves essential in the ministry that is the priesthood of all believers. I was recently on a plane, and the stewardess, excuse me, the flight attendant, was very enthusiastic about her job. And I've seen flight attendants be polite. But this flight attendant seemed very committed to doing her job with enthusiasm. She was really looking for opportunities to help. She really felt it. And that's a good thing, to be a cheerful giver. But we give even when we're not cheerful. We can't say, well, we're going to wait around to give when we get cheerful. We have to do that which is important, even though it hurts. Because, again, Jesus is our model. Seems to me I read something about the agony of crucifixion, about sweating drops of blood, about having real reservations and mental torment, and yet we still do it. And that is something we know too. We are parents, after all, many of us. We are husbands and wives, and we know that love takes hard work. We do it. So who are we? We are the people who are members of the priesthood of all believers. contribute in some way. And so we come to this church on Sunday mornings. We come to Christ not just to fulfill our desires, not just to satisfy our ambitions, but to raise our aspirations, to elevate our vision so that we can indeed think about the community of which we're a part, the community of La Persona, the community of the entire world. That is our calling. And so we end with this. This gal, Mother Teresa, we ourselves feel that what we are doing is just a drop in the ocean. But if that drop were not there, I think the ocean would be less by that missing drop. Let us pray. God, we know that we are not the sum total of our successes or failures. We know that it's never over. We still have a role to play. The question of who am I is a question that doesn't go away because our roles change. We lose jobs. We experience a change in our role as parents. We lose other roles that we've cherished, in which we have thrived. And so we are constantly asking, who am I? And yet, you come to us and help us to see that we are not selves alone, but we are, in fact, people who are joined to other people, joined to the whole earth. And so we ask that you would help us to have that same mindset as Jesus Christ, so that we could see ourselves not as isolated, but as connected to one another. And we ask this in Jesus' name.